From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our topic on this edition of the program, the U.S. Supreme Court ends nearly 50 years of abortion rights. As a leaked opinion in May suggested, the High Court, which now has a solid conservative majority, overturned Roe v. Wade, eliminating a constitutional right to an abortion. This ruling now gives all 50 states the freedom to regulate or ban the procedure. The decision met with praise from anti-abortion advocates and outrage and sorrow from abortion rights supporters. Protests against the decision broke out across the nation on Friday, June 24, when the ruling became public, and have persisted to this day. Opinion polls show that almost 60% of Americans oppose the court's ruling to overturn the 1973 landmark precedent establishing a constitutional right to an abortion. To discuss the lead up to the decision, ramifications for abortion access, which may lead to bans on the procedure in about half of the states, and what the decision says about the nature and direction of the Supreme Court, we turn to Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS Blog, an online publication which tracks and analyzes decisions rendered by the Supreme Court. Amy also writes for her eponymous blog, Howe on the Court. Before turning to full-time blogging, Amy Howe co-taught Supreme Court litigation at Stanford and Harvard Law Schools. She has also served as adjunct professor at American University's Washington College of Law and Vanderbilt Law School. According to the New York Times, quote, "The ruling will test the legitimacy of the court and vindicate a decades-long Republican project of installing conservative justices prepared to reject the precedent which had been affirmed by earlier courts. It will also be one of the signal legacies of former President Donald Trump, who vowed to name justices who would overrule Roe, all three of his appointees, Justice Gorsuch, Justice Kavanaugh, and Justice Coney Barrett, were in the majority in the ruling to overturn Roe v. Wade." Supreme Court observer Amy Howe will dissect the decision and its many implications, and she joins us via Microsoft Teams. Amy Howe, welcome to the program.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, Amy, let's start with your reaction. You're a watcher of the Supreme Court. What is your reaction to the decision, which we knew was coming, the overturning of Roe v. Wade in 1973? And what were, in your view, the main reasons used by Justice Samuel Alito to overturn this landmark precedent?
So the decision wasn't really a surprise. Obviously, the draft majority opinion had been leaked in early May, and that suggested that the court was poised to overrule Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. But even before the draft opinion was leaked, it seemed likely after the oral argument in December of 2021 that the justices were poised to roll back abortion rights. The fact that they even decided to hear the case suggested that they believed that they had five votes to uphold the Mississippi law and perhaps overturn Roe and Casey. The decision by Justice Alito relied on the text of the Constitution and on history and precedent. Justice Alito looked at the text of the Constitution and said there's nothing in the Constitution that establishes a right to an abortion. And there's nothing in the history of old English law and the early days of U.S. law that would suggest that the founding fathers believed there should be a right to an abortion protected by the Constitution. Indeed, Justice Alito said, up until the second half of the 20th century, Roe versus Wade is a decision that's nearly 50 years old. Abortion was a crime in many states.
So, Amy Howe, let's dig a little bit further into this decision, because we're seeing a split screen. We're seeing a majority of Americans who are opposed to this ruling. People are out on the streets. Women are concerned about access to abortion, reproductive rights in general. So let's take a brief look at the politics of this, the nature of this court. As I said in the introduction, it is pretty much Donald Trump's court. Many would argue, but for his appointees, perhaps this decision might not have been overturned. What do you make of that argument, the actual makeup of the court, the three justices, and how they changed the direction of the court so far, in particular on this decision?
I think there's a lot to it. When he was campaigning for president in 2015 and 2016, then candidate Donald Trump promised that he would appoint what he called pro-life justices, justices who would vote to overturn the decisions in Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. He also took the unusual step a couple of months before the election in November of 2016 of releasing a list of potential Supreme Court nominees. And he said, I will choose a nominee from this list if there are vacancies. And that move likely was a key aspect of Trump's support in the November 2016 elections. I think there were likely doubts among social conservatives about Donald Trump. He was a man who, on his third wife, had a history of being a Democrat, not someone that some social conservatives were likely to support. But social conservatives feel and felt very strongly about the issue of abortion, had been wanting to get a majority on the Supreme Court to overturn Roe and Casey. And so they were willing to vote for him because of what they believed it would mean for the Supreme Court and federal courts, particularly on the issue of abortion. And by winning in 2016, Trump then had the opportunity, as it turned out, to appoint three justices to the Supreme Court in 4 years. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell put off a hearing for Merrick Garland, who's now the Attorney General of the United States, but was President Barack Obama's nominee to fill the seat that was created when Justice Antonin Scalia, one of the court's conservative members, passed away in February of 2016. And then 4 years later, the same Senate Majority Leader, Mitch McConnell, went ahead and held a hearing and pushed through the confirmation of Justice Amy Coney Barrett when Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg died in September of 2020. Both of those moves were critical because it would have left a different balance on the court if either of those had not happened. If either Merrick Garland had replaced Justice Scalia or President Joe Biden had the opportunity to replace Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, there would be, in all likelihood, four liberal justices on the court. And then you have Chief Justice John Roberts, who in the decision in the Mississippi case said that he would not have formally overruled Roe and Casey. He would have left those decisions in place, even though he would have also allowed the Mississippi law to stand.
An excellent transition. Let's segue now to Chief Justice John Roberts, because as you said, it was a 5-4 decision on Roe v. Wade, even though he upheld the Mississippi decision. He made that distinction. He was reluctant to reverse precedent. So talk about what we call stare decisis, what that means, and how uncommon is it to overturn precedent? As some argue, the court had never before eliminated an individual constitutional right such as Roe v. Wade allowed and handed the power to the state governments. So talk about the implications of that.
Yes. So there is a doctrine in U.S. law called stare decisis, and that is the idea that courts should not overturn their prior precedent unless there is a compelling reason to do so. And one of the main arguments made by the abortion providers in urging the Supreme Court to strike down the Mississippi law was the doctrine of stare decisis. They said that Roe versus Wade has been in place for a half a century, and the Supreme Court reaffirmed the core holding of Roe versus Wade in 1992 in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And the liberal justices agreed, Justice Sonia Sotomayor and Justice Stephen Breyer, Justice Elena Kagan really pressed this point at the oral argument that this was not just about abortion, but whether or not the country would view the Supreme Court and the ruling as less than legitimate because the decision would really just hinge on changes in the makeup of the court. Justice Samuel Alito, in his opinion for the majority, addressed the idea of stare decisis at some length. He wrote that this case met all of the different factors that the justices have outlined for cases in which it is appropriate to overrule their prior precedent. And he suggested that if the Supreme Court can't overrule its prior precedent, even if it's a longstanding one, that the United States would not have decisions like Brown versus Board of Education, which rejected the doctrine of separate but equal for schools, overturned an old decision called Plessy versus Ferguson that was really reviled.
Well, that's very true. And I think many would disagree that this decision to overturn Roe v. Wade is in any way analogous to Brown versus Board of Education, which overturned the Plessy versus Ferguson. But I guess that's another issue for another day. But let's take a quick break and we shall be right back. You are listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Amy Howe, co-founder of SCOTUS Blog and a Supreme Court observer and reporter. We are discussing the implications of the U.S. Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe versus Wade, which eliminates nationwide access to abortion services. I'm Carol Castiel. This is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available on most of your favorite podcast apps. You may also listen to us by downloading the link at voaafrica.com/PCUSA. And feel free to follow us on Twitter at @Carol_Castiel or connect with us on Facebook at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Gamidal Osman Abubar, and he's a native of Somalia living in Dubai. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our special guest, Amy Howe, and she's helping us to dissect this decision by the Supreme Court to overturn Roe versus Wade, which had allowed women access to abortion across the country. And now that decision, Amy, is going back to the states. But let me talk about one more criticism by those who are very unhappy with this ruling overturning Roe versus Wade. And that has to do with what is called due process, the due process argument. That has to do with eliminating the constitutional right to privacy. And I'm going to be quoting from Hussein Ibish, who wrote an article, an opinion piece saying that, quote, Chief Justice Roberts failed to secure a compromise to save the constitutional right to privacy, which undergirded Roe v. Wade. Now, he says, basic rights such as contraception and marriage equality have no established constitutional basis. And he is concerned that those rights that Americans have taken for granted over the past several years, that is a right to contraception and marriage equality, are now under scrutiny and may also be liable to being overturned. And we saw that in an opinion rendered by Justice Clarence Thomas, who basically didn't rule that out and actually advocated for that. What is your take on that?
That's right. So Justice Thomas agreed with the majority decision. He joined that majority, but then he wrote a separate opinion in which he suggested that decisions like Griswold versus Connecticut, which established the right to contraception, Lawrence versus Texas, which established the right to same-sex intimacy, and Obergefell versus Hodges established the right to same-sex marriage, are in doubt. There is a doctrine in U.S. law called substantive due process, which is the idea that the Constitution's due process clause protects not only against the government not giving you a fair shake in terms of process. They can't take away your life, your liberty, or your property without the proper procedures. But the idea that the due process clause also protects substantive rights that are not necessarily outlined in the Constitution. And the majority addressed this point. It said that those rights, the right to same-sex marriage, the right to contraception, are different from the right to abortion because only abortion involves the purposeful termination of life. And so the majority suggested, in essence, don't worry about these other rights, that they're going to be fine. But Thomas, in his concurring opinion, suggested that at least for him, they are very much in doubt.
So we are looking at potential revision of these rulings for same-sex marriage and contraception, notwithstanding the denials by other justices like Justice Samuel Alito and I believe Brett Kavanaugh. But I guess time will tell. Nonetheless, what we are seeing, Amy Howe, is what many Americans perceive as an undermining of the credibility of the legitimacy of the Supreme Court. And let me quote another a very centrist, actually, foreign policy expert, a former official in the George H.W. Bush administration, and that is Richard Haass. He is the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, and he said in a tweet referring to the Roe versus Wade decision, quote, "American democracy, if it is to endure, needs a SCOTUS, that is Supreme Court, widely accepted as an impartial referee. But this court, by how it was constituted and by rulings that appear to be more about policy than law, has for many forfeited its legitimacy. Our democracy is in deeper danger as a result." Close quote. How do you view these types of comments, particularly as you're a Supreme Court watcher and observer? To what extent do you think maybe some real damage is being done by this particular court and the decisions that they are issuing? And not just this Roe versus Wade, but we're seeing a number of decisions on gun rights, as well as potential blurring of the separation of church and state, allowing for prayer on the football field in a recent decision, which some have criticized. Again, your take.
So there have been polls recently suggesting that the Supreme Court's approval ratings are at record lows. And so the question really is, what happens next? And so the Supreme Court doesn't have its own army or anything like that. The Supreme Court's ability to have its rulings be carried out rests on its legitimacy to a certain extent. And presumably, perceptions about the legitimacy are linked to the public approval ratings that we see in polls. And so the question is, what happens next? As somebody who has been watching the Supreme Court for over two decades now, the Supreme Court has hit low points before, after decisions like Bush versus Gore and Citizens United. The public has had doubts about its confidence in the Supreme Court, and the court has generally rebounded after these decisions. And the question is whether or not it will be able to do so again. But as the dissenters wrote in their dissent, which was almost as long as the majority opinion, was that the public shouldn't believe or feel that what the Constitution means depends solely on the makeup of the Supreme Court, so that having this new influx of justices can change the Supreme Court's interpretation of the Constitution. And the court's public approval rating certainly suggests that that is a factor.
Indeed. And of course, I'm going to be quoting again from Hussein Ibish, who said most of the court majority during their confirmations called abortion rights settled law or important precedent, or both, and they vowed to uphold stare decisis and reject judicial activism that might impose their personal beliefs. But as Hussein says, they seem to have jumped at the first opportunity to do exactly that. So that can't help with the court's credibility when they see what is perceived as hypocrisy. And others see also religious zealotry. A lot of them are Catholics, but so are many of the liberals. But others see the imposition of a Catholic or a radical Christian agenda with some of these decisions, in particular Roe versus Wade, the overturning, and seeing that life begins at conception. That seems to underlie without them saying so publicly. And another comment is that where one side, that is those who see abortion rights as a fundamental rights, as a woman's right to choose how to deal with her reproductive needs. So that's healthcare. And the other side sees homicide. Anything that would destroy a fetus would be homicide. So we have these cultural wars in this country. They're swirling around this incredible decision that the country is dealing with. But let's go now to the fact that abortion rights now are in the hands of the states, Amy Howe. So let's see, where do we go from here? What are so-called trigger laws? What are they, and where and why will they start to take effect?
So trigger laws is a name for laws that were passed in anticipation of the prospect that the Supreme Court might overrule Roe versus Wade and Planned Parenthood versus Casey. Sort of laws in waiting that would go into effect and restrict abortions in a particular state once the court overruled Roe and Casey without the need for any further action from the legislature in a particular state.
Very good. So, and tell us about, what do women do now? I mean, I think, if I'm not mistaken, About half the states may either ban or strictly regulate access to abortion, requiring women to cross state lines. And that's going to disproportionately affect minority women, economically distressed women. And so talk about the implications for the states and how it's going to most likely burden many states like California, New York, Illinois, and others who still allow abortion to take place, and those states where it will be completely banned, and the burden it will place on women and families who seek to terminate their pregnancies.
I mean, I think you captured it pretty well. The Guttmacher Institute estimated before the decision in Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization, the Mississippi case, that abortion would be banned or severely restricted in roughly half the states. And so what the court's decision means or is likely to mean is that access to abortion will depend largely on where you live and the resources that you have. A woman in a state like Louisiana or Texas that has no access to abortion in that particular state could have to drive as far as Illinois or Maryland to get an abortion. And so it obviously becomes much more difficult for low-income women to do that, to make the trip, taking a couple of days off of work, the actual cost to travel to a state where abortion is available. And as you said, some states like California are taking action to try to make sure that anyone who comes to the state who wants an abortion will have access to that abortion without making it more difficult for residents of a state like California, where abortion is legal, to obtain abortions because the capacity is limited. It's just a question of how this is actually going to play out.
And of course, now many people are looking to the executive branch, to President Biden. What can he conceivably do? His hands are tied in many ways, Amy Howe. But for now, evidently, the president can, at least based on a statement he made, ensure that women are able to cross state lines without prosecution, that they should be able to seek this procedure wherever they can without being penalized. And also they have a right to medical abortions, that they can still access abortion pills. Do you see those two attempts to circumvent this ruling being pressured or somehow curtailed? Or do you think that the executive branch can at least ensure crossing state lines and the right to medical abortion, which evidently is common, and perhaps almost 50% of abortions are through the use of pills as opposed to surgical procedures?
Yes. So let me unpack that. Justice Brett Kavanaugh actually filed a concurring opinion. He too joined the Alito majority opinion, but he suggested that states might not be able to penalize traveling to another state to obtain an abortion or punishing someone for a prior abortion. As far as the statement by the president that the Biden administration would continue to ensure that medication abortions were available no matter where a woman lived, my understanding is that the medication abortions are popular, but only available for women in the earlier stages of pregnancy, that they are not available, I think, after the 10th week of pregnancy. And the other potential problem from the perspective of abortion rights supporters is that an order from President Joe Biden directing the FDA to continue to make medication abortions available is not something that would necessarily remain in perpetuity if a Republican administration were to take office in 2024 or 2028. That administration, a Trump administration or a DeSantis administration, could direct the FDA to do something different.
And that brings us to the impact on the midterm elections and what the legislative branch can or can't do. And of course, many Democrats and some moderate Republicans, independents, are suggesting that people get out the vote and try to bring in a majority that could pass legislation to codify abortion rights, that would affirm Americans' rights to travel freely between states in case any states would go so far as to try to punish women for doing so. And of course, the fundamental right, or what many see as a right to, for women in particularly those, you know, who are victims of rape or incest, or whose health and life are in danger if they do not terminate their pregnancy, that some protection, you know, of this sort be codified. So what do you think is the possibility of any legislative action, either in the short term up until the end of the year, when we either have a new Congress next January, potentially a Republican-led House of Representatives, or just in the short time that the Democrats have still a very narrow control over both the Senate and the House of Representatives? What could possibly be done on the legislative level?
There are a couple of options for Congress. Certainly, the idea of passing a national law that would guarantee access to abortion, that law could be subject to challenge as unconstitutional and could go to a Supreme Court with a conservative majority. And then there's the prospect of what the effect of the decision has on voter turnout and votes in the 2022 midterms, which I think is really too early to tell. I think that there are many people who right now are very angry about this decision and say that they will show up and vote. And the question is, will they in fact do so?
That is really the question. There are so many implications, political, ideological, and of course, with respect to health care for women and families, about this stunning decision, which we did see, as you said, evolving to this point in the sense that former President Trump was able to get those three justices on the court. This is where we are today. And we will just have to see in the weeks and months ahead how this will play out in terms of access to abortion services for those women who seek them and what the states will do. So as we say in the profession, watch this space. And I want to thank you. Amy Howe is a veteran Supreme Court watcher and co-founder of SCOTUS blog. Amy Howe, thank you so much for your time and insights and ability to dissect and analyze the implications of this very important Supreme Court ruling. We greatly appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. It was great to talk to you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. Thanks to Haley Qualls for booking our guest. I'm Carol Castiel.
Before we close, I urge you to listen to our companion program, Encounter. We will discuss this weekend the outcomes of the NATO summit in Madrid. Here's an editorial of the U.S. government affirming the importance of admitting Sweden and Finland to NATO. Turkey has since dropped its objections to their accession.
On May 18th, Finland and Sweden submitted applications for membership in the NATO alliance. Historically, Finland and Sweden have been militarily non-aligned, a stance that reflected the preferences of their people. As recently as January 2022, only about 20% of the population of Finland favored NATO membership. That number rose to 53% after Russian President Vladimir Putin's February 24th invasion of Ukraine. And by mid-May, some 76% of Finns believe that Finland should join NATO. Finland is a free and open society, said Secretary of State Antony Blinken. The move was driven by strong public support.
Finnish people, press, and politicians debated the prospect openly. And when the country's democratically elected parliament put the issue to a vote, 188 out of 200 members supported applying for membership. That is what a democratic process looks like.
Finland and Sweden's applications also reaffirm NATO's open door policy, which has been a cornerstone of the alliance since its very founding, said Secretary Blinken.
That door will stay open, reflecting our belief that every country should have the right to choose its allies and partners and to pursue membership if it chooses. That is not a provocation or a threat to Russia. We say this often, but it bears repeating. NATO is and always will be a defensive alliance.
Nonetheless, attaining membership in NATO is neither rapid nor easy. Accession requires candidate countries to advance through an application process. Ultimately, all current NATO allies must approve the membership. And when it comes to Finland and Sweden, one ally, Turkey, has expressed opposition. However, said Secretary Blinken, Finland and Sweden are working directly with Turkey to address some of the concerns that it raised. The United States fully supports Finland and Sweden joining the alliance, said Secretary Blinken, and I continue to be confident that both countries will soon be NATO allies.
That was an editorial from the U.S. government. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.